Blog Talk Radio.
Several top secret government studies, both
in the United States and the United Kingdom predict an eerie future. Over the next 25 years, the world would turn into a Big Brother nightmare where a small rich elite thrives on the backs of a starving population.
And, well, that's a pretty scary thought, isn't it?
Yeah, and the prologue is quite long, but I, you know, I think, I think the most frightening part of all this is that, to me, what struck out is he used the 2015 as the day. That's next year.
As the year.
But our friend and a regular on our show, Bill Marshall, was a cosmobiologist. He passed away in 2007. But Bill predicted that, Bill predicted many things. He predicted 9/11 back in the year 2000. He predicted the financial crash of 2009. He predicted the fall of Iraq and the death of Saddam Hussein a year before that happened. And he also predicted a revolution, an American revolution, in 2015. Now, that's
I don't remember exactly the
Yeah, that was a private prediction. And he was making a number of predictions that, to me, all right, and the one that scared him the most, these predictions were made in 2005, 2006, when
mm-hmm.
he made them, and he made them on television, some of them, on my television show, and he made a lot of them on our radio show, but these particular ones he made to me in private, he said, I can't believe it, because he used to predict stocks, you know that?
Hmm.
He used to predict stocks, and he did very well, you know, he used to predict them on with astrology, and he told me that in 2015, the country's going to be in a revolution, all right? I said, no kidding, really? He said, yeah. In 2009, he says the bottom is going to drop out financially. He says it's going to wipe everybody out, and it did. All right. But the 2015 prediction was really quite frightening to me because of such an accuracy that the guy had. And now when I saw him putting 2015 in this book. He may have done it just as an arbitrary date, but Bill's date was right on the money. And if you look around you and you look around at the world right now, man, we are, everybody's in revolution, right? Ukraine, Thailand, Egypt, Spain, countries all over the world are in turmoil,
Turmoil.
What is that, turmoil?
Turmoil.
Turmoil. Turmoil. They're all in turmoil. Okay. All they are is they're in trouble. They're in big trouble, and this is happening everywhere. But the reason for that, folks, is because Dan talks about it in his book tonight, and we're looking at the collapse of the world monetary system. Collapse of the world economic system is a pre-planned part of the global takeover by the world corporation, if you will. Which means that there's just a small number of corporations that are basically own and operate the entire world, all the corporations in the world, which own and operate all the governments in the world. All right.
So, and then there'll be one government.
Yeah. So one world corporation is what they're looking at. So anyway, what kind of scares me about this whole thing is really isn't just that, but it's going to happen, and it's out there, and
it's
people.
Already happening.
Yeah, people are going, wow, And I don't know.
They have many tools, and one of the biggest ones is the media. To keep everybody thinking they have something that they don't have at all.
I'm very surprised. I'm going to quote a guy tonight because he basically quoted what I wrote in my book. Dennis Jackson, face, he's a friend of mine, and he was the owner of the WQQQ, on the station. And I never thought he was a Republican. I thought he was a Democrat. He was a liberal guy. But he claims that, I'm looking at his Facebook thing here, and he says, I'm still a Republican, but national party attitudes embarrass me. This seems a better description of my aspirations. Now, liberal. What does a liberal mean? Possessing or manifesting a free and generous heart, bountiful, appropriate and or fitting for a broad and enlightened mind, free from narrowness, bigotry, or bondage to authority or creed. Any person who advocates liberty of thought, speech, or action. That's, you know, that's Webster's Dictionary. My quote on Webster's Dictionary, Unabridged Dictionary, stated that a liberal was someone who believed in the betterment of mankind.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And in that same Webster's Dictionary, a conservative is someone who believes in the worst of mankind.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Which is very interesting. All right? But I think it's interesting that, and Dennis goes on to write, the increase in income inequality can be blamed on the 30-year Reagan Revolution. The seductive trickle-down theory that turns out to be more like trickle-down. When I reminisce about the Grand Deception, I picture the charming old B actor at the podium, briefly distracted by a neocon who was feeding him lines that so many of us swallowed. He was an effective mouthpiece for the 1% who continued to hold sway. Well,
he was only an instrument.
He was just an instrument. And, but, Dennis is a liberal. He allowed our show on the air for 8 years. He brought us on the air during the most controversial period of time in American history.
And certainly, in the history of the media.
History of the media, where total conservative control of the media. We came on, he brought us in, and put us on the air, and we became a very well-listened-to, big-hit, controversial radio show. And we all thank Dennis
for allowing us to be on.
He put up with a lot of heat for having us. And 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite a run.
Joe Libero was the station manager at the time.
We were one of the longest running liberal talk shows in the United States at the time, believe it or not. No, we even outlasted. We were on a year before America.
Mm-hmm.
And we were on 2 years after they went belly up.
We thought we did okay in retrospect. We really did.
And we're on the air still. We've been on Blog Talk for since 2006, and we're on FM radio with Q103 till 2011.
Well, it was Leo's idea to start this Blog Talk radio show. He always thought, well, there's going to be a day when we won't be on our FM show anymore. Something will happen at the station
or to the station. That's right.
And as it happened, it was not about us. It was more about the station.
And the economics and stuff like that. Dennis sold leased the station out to NPR for economic reasons. But anyway, we had a long, long run. And we're grateful for Dennis for keeping us on as long as he could. And let's see. I don't know.
All kinds of things going on.
There was. I got so many good stuff, good things. I just wanted to. I got a lot of stuff for tomorrow night too. Came up. Tomorrow night we talk about our union issues.
What week?
I got a couple of things. Excuse me a sec.
How about Albert Einstein's quote, the world is a dangerous place to live, not because of the people who are evil, but because of the people who don't do anything about it.
That's absolutely true. Yeah. We're trying, folks. We try. We really, really try to get stuff out, and we've been doing it for a long time. Doing it. Lila and I have been working at it for 14 years.
But it's very difficult to be up against.
14 years together.
The mass media who...
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, God.
Has everybody so brainwashed?
Doesn't matter.
And so manipulated.
If you don't know how to use them, it will never be enough. That's true.
What's that? Couldn't he?
I said, yeah, a friend of mine sent me, it doesn't matter how many resources you have, if you don't know how to use them, it will never be enough.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. Okay. What I wanted to do, there's so much stuff. You know, it's Tuesday night, and I get inundated with news items and stuff. People send me a lot of stuff, a lot of great stuff. You see all this stuff for Tuesday night on a Facebook wall? And they ask me, quote, I mean, it just really go berserk bottom.
Well, one of the things that's so scary about looking into the future concerning these people, that group, the elitists that are controlling the world, is that they are controlling the things that are so vital to our existence. They're controlling water, they're controlling food, and they're manipulating each of those things, and the air.
Yeah. I agree.
Medicine, disease.
Yeah, that's a tremendous number of things. You know, I'm going to go to a quick I want to go to a quick music break. I'll tell you what, because I'm friends with Facebook friends with Johnny Winters. And I don't know if anybody knows Johnny out there, but he's a master guitar player.
Uh-huh.
And master bluesman and master. And he sent over this YouTube of him in 87 in Germany, one of his performances.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured he did that maybe so I would play it. Uh-huh. He does that. Seems like every Tuesday night and Wednesday night, he sends those over, so I got a feeling he might be listening. But for your sake there, Johnny Winters, Winter, we're going to play this little rock and roll classic performance from Essen, Germany. Johnny Winters.
Thank you.
And if you go to YouTube, just put up Tony Blair on YouTube. There's a bunch of good stuff there. But if you ever want to get down, and or if ever you're down and you want to get up, put on a good Johnny Winter's. Johnny Winter will get you going. So let's see. One of the things I wanted to talk about tonight.
I want to play that on the
ABC
guide.
I don't know if I can. I don't know if I can do that one, and I'll tell you why. Because it's registered to ABC. But I can try.
There it is.
I get the sound right here. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Below that.
Yeah.
Right there.
No, that's proof Osama's Muslim. Yeah. And then I got one that I wanted to talk another quick video about Kerry's feud with Israel.
Dr. Richard Sasser.
Yeah, let's see if I can get this one going here. WeScience.com. Doctor top and 80 seasons. Top doctor argues with legalizing marijuana. He's in favor of it. Argues for legalizing marijuana.
Hmm.
I thought we should listen to this. It's about 6 minutes long, but I think listening to the reasons why is probably a good idea. Huh?
See what he has to say.
And let's take a listen now with our expert, which is with us, along with Allison Holcomb from Washington State's ACLU. Thomas back as well, and Ricardo Bobka, the marijuana editor of the Denver Post. No major papers ever had that post before. Welcome.
Thank you.
To you as well. Let me start out with you, because you surprised me a little bit here. You said you started out skeptical of the arguments for legalization, but it's kind of evolved.
Yeah, you know, I'm a parent of two teenage boys. I'm a pediatrician, and I'm very concerned about the impact on the developing brain from frequent use. And so I went into the story thinking there's no way this should be legal. But the more I got into the story, the more I was convinced by the arguments around the comparison between alcohol and its dangers and marijuana. And it's just not rational that adults don't have the choice of using marijuana, but they do for alcohol. Marijuana is less likely to be addictive. It's less likely to cause car accidents and birth defects. It's less likely to cause domestic violence. So how do you rationally say that it's okay to drink alcohol with that profile, but it's not okay to occasionally use marijuana?
How do you do that, Pierre?
Well, it's interesting. I spent some time doing some research, talking to law enforcement officials, and one of the things they point out is that this is not your daddy's marijuana, that the marijuana today is 3 times more powerful if you look at the THC, which is the active ingredient. And they're very concerned about the effect on younger people. So that's one of the things they're concerned about. And also they say that you have to look at how is the legal system going to adjust to accommodate this. You saw with the state trooper, there's no way to test for it really on the highway.
And I want to bring that to Ricardo now, because you're on the ground with this beat, this marijuana beat in Colorado, and it is unprecedented. I have to ask you the first question you probably always get. So do you use it?
I do, yeah. I use it both medically and recreationally.
Okay, and then what are you seeing on the ground? I was most struck by one of your observations. You actually can smell the difference in Denver and Boulder?
You can. If you went back a couple of years in the metro area and took a big whiff in downtown Denver, downtown Boulder, you know, it would have been your average city. But now I think if you're at a Bronco game, if you're out in downtown Denver, you can actually smell the difference. We were at the Justin Timberlake concert just a few weeks ago, and you could definitely smell the difference there. And it's, of course, it's been ever-present at concerts for decades.
What's the biggest challenge so far?
The biggest challenge, you know, it comes down to keeping it out of kids' hands, but also keeping it from crossing state lines. When that Justice Department memo came out saying, Colorado, Washington, go for it, but we're watching you, you know, it's just like we have to pay attention to those bits and pieces that are very important.
You're part of the campaign in Washington State to have it legalized, and this is, you know, the sort of the forefront of efforts. We're starting to see efforts in other states as well.
Right. We are. We're seeing Oregon, Alaska, California is looking at it. They don't know when they're going with it. I think what you're seeing nationwide is that the conversation has changed from, does it make sense for us to continue treating this like a criminal matter, to how can we do this in a responsible way where we're not only focusing on keeping it out of the kids' hands, but maybe we're also providing kids some proactive information to help them make better choices for themselves.
And, you know, we're with the president this week. He made a powerful argument. He tried to clarify his arguments where he said, listen, it's just not fair that if you're a young African-American kid, you're going to get a far harsher sentence than someone else. But then doesn't that potentially lead to the argument is why not just stop at decriminalization? Why go all the way towards legalization?
I think the concern with stopping with decriminalization is that we do have to address the black market. If we don't address the black market, kids are going to keep getting marijuana that's three times as strong as THC. That's happening outside of any sort of regulatory structure. We need the regulations, we need licensing, we need standards.
And then the other counter-argument to the argument you were making, Rich Besser, is, yeah, pot may be no worse than alcohol, but once you get a whole lot of money marketing behind it, it's going to be impossible. We've seen it with cigarettes. We've seen it with alcohol. The kids are going to start using it earlier and earlier and potentially get hooked.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that is one area there has to be a lot of focus on regulation. And we also have to look really closely at what happens in Colorado and Washington State and learn from that experience. I do worry about kids using this, and we have to be clear in this, that it's not a signal saying it's okay for kids to smoke pot. But I know in the community we live in, kids are smoking pot without this, and hopefully bringing it away from the black market and bringing it out in the open, we're able to get those messages through in a better way.
Is that signal being sent in Colorado? Do you feel that?
It's definitely being sent. I mean, and Rich makes a good point. I mean, this is in middle school. This is in high schools. It's everywhere, but the education process is very serious. I know the state has been making inroads in actually high schools and going out and having conversations. And we take our job responsibly in terms of educating the public, too. This is a strong product. You know, start with...
Do you write about that?
I do. Oh, yeah, yeah. We've written multiple times about just the sheer strength of it and good amounts. It's good to start if you're new with 5 milligrams of an edible. It's a very solid way of measuring the amount of pot that you're about to ingest.
George, one of the things that struck me about this whole thing is when you start to look at the marijuana, Americans have had a love affair with marijuana. If you look at the black market, they're trucking it into the country by the hundreds of tons. I went to a location, secret location where the government disposes of the illegal. They're disposing of it by forklift. It's just incredible to see.
And it's going to be really hard, Rich Besser, to keep out of the hands of kids.
I think it is. I mean, right now it's hard to keep alcohol out of the hands of kids. It's hard to keep marijuana out of the hands of kids. And we need to do a better job around that. And I think a lot of that comes down to parenting. Education in school is one thing, but it comes down to what are you saying at home and what examples are you setting. But this doesn't change that. The fact that it's illegal now, kids are using this. It's rampant. Saying it's legal for adults to use that is I think, a rational approach.
That is all we have time for. I wish we had more time. I want you all to come back at some point. Thank you all very much.
All right. Now, I played that because I'm a firm believer in marijuana legalization.
Well, I find it interesting they have such a wide-open discussion on the media. So that means it's going to be legalized, folks.
Yes, exactly. When a doctor,
because they are molding
us. Exactly. A prominent doctor comes out on this and says, you know, legalize
I have two
it,
kids,
legalize
and
it,
I think
legalize.
It's fine.
Right. You know, so it's like, you know, we've been saying this all along. And I'm going to tell you something, the truth. This three times more powerful than your dad's marijuana is so bull crap, right? I mean,
by the way,
it's so bull. I mean, we used to get, back in the days, okay, when back in the 60s and 70s, When pot was coming in through the bushels, barrels of tons and tons of it coming through Jamaica and Acapulco gold, and you had all kinds of different stuff. You had all, you know, this stuff was great. Now, this was, like, fantastic stuff. It was a wonderful world at that time, and it was reasonably priced.
Well, it's no different.
I don't think there's any three times more powerful.
But Leo, don't you think it's no different than, you know, alcohol?
Oh yeah. Well, it's kind of like
different
bourbon.
Grapes.
Yeah, bourbon will get you a little drunk a little faster, and vodka will get you faster drunk than a beer.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So
same
yeah.
Kind of thing.
So basically, it's the same thing. You know, here's kiddie weed, and here's adult weed. You know,
mm-hmm.
That kind of thing, I guess. But you know, it's great. That hopefully it's great for everything, and I think that's
important. Well, I think that's the most important thing,
yeah,
is to look at what it does for people medically.
Absolutely.
People with, you know, serious health issues,
yeah, you know.
Can be helped, and their pain can be...
Exactly. You know, for so many diseases, and it cures cancer. It's been documented that it cures cancer. So, you know, I just wanted to read this, because I thought this was this one is, the War of Words comes days after actress Scarlett Johansson ended her 8-year affiliation with Oxfam due to their opposition to Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Johansson appeared in a Super Bowl ad for SodaStream, a company based in Israel that runs a large facility on the West Bank. On Monday, CNN anchor Michaela Pereira devoted a news brief on the new day to Kerry's remarks and the Israeli government reaction. All right, and here is the video of it. I think this is kind of interesting.
Harsh words for John Kerry from the Israelis. Two high-ranking cabinet ministers accusing the Secretary of State of trying to undermine Israel's legitimacy. Those comments coming after Kerry warned Jerusalem it was facing the threat of an international boycott because of its West Bank settlement. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu calling any attempt to boycott Israel unmoral and unjust.
There you go.
Yeah, right.
Immoral and unjust. Yeah, right. Oh, God. But it's all right to kick the Palestinians off their land, cut their trees down, destroy their farms, shoot them, kill them,
mm-hmm,
you know, butcher
Don't,
them.
Don't hurt their children.
You know, yeah, and but that's
Bill,
okay, Netanyahu, babe. You know, yeah, you can go
build,
out and kill
and,
them
and
all.
Build,
yeah, what an unbelievable.
Can I speak?
Unbelievable.
And build a wall,
yeah,
that's higher than the Berlin Wall.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Walling them in, it's an open-air concentration camp.
Yeah.
Basically. And then cut off all their services, water,
yeah,
electric. And
it's an apartheid state,
mm-hmm,
folks. And, you know, just, you know.
And, you know, when people get on TV here and they say Israel's a democracy, they don't even know what they're talking about.
They have no idea what they're talking about. You know, if democracy is where you destroy and mutilate and kill little children and, you know, destroy.
If anything, it's
God,
a theocracy.
Steal land.
You have to be a Jew to,
yes,
get any rights there.
That's right. You know, so it's a joke, folks. Zionism is a joke. Israel is a joke. So let's go to, if you want to, this is a sad little thing, that, but I have a lot of Native Americans that, you know, I friends with. On Facebook, a lot of friends that I have there that I have basically because I'm part myself. But the woman called Featherspeak, she sent this portrait, this picture of a child's scalp was worth $25. Okay? The scalp industry, although the origins of the practicing of scalping may be lost in the nebulous hinterlands of interlands of the past, the industry of scalp hunting has a specific and documented history. Although some of the particulars may be shrouded in rumors, the scalp bounty was instituted a peculiar economic venture between the Mexican government and primarily American citizens. Between 1835 and 1880, the Mexican authorities paid private armies to hunt Native Americans, paying per kill and using scalps as receipts. The practice began when the Mexican government could no longer provide adequate protection to its citizens from the marauding Apaches and Comanches, and then Natives rode down from the U.S., killing peons, kidnapping women, and stealing livestock, and then would escape back over the border. Well, because the Mexican military was unable to effectively ward off the threat over such a large expanse, and because the Mexican farmer either could not afford or were forbidden to possess arms, the government had to look to alternative methods of suppressing Native violence. But bounty laws, Sonora was the first state to enact a scalp bounty. In 1835, offering 100 pesos for the scalps of braves in a peso roughly equal to an American silver dollar. Hmm. And an American named James Johansson sparked the boom period in 1837 when he fired a concealed cannon at close range or unarmed Apaches. The blast tore into Apache warriors as well as women and children, and Johnson and his troops swarmed in the mass of natives, killing and scalping. Well, this event occurred in Hidalgo County, New Mexico. The scalps were cashed in Sonora, and the entire incident proved how profitable scalp hunting could be. It also flamed native animosity toward both Mexicans and Anglos, encouraging more raids and greater violence, a cycle that continued throughout this era. And so afterwards, Chihuahua enacted a similar law of offering a graded bounty of $100 for braves, $50 for squaws, $25 for children, and under 14. And although the latter two were ostensibly for live captives, while the callous nature of this business might have limited the numbers of participants, the panic of 1837 had left many pioneers and miners strapped for money. And scalp hunting...
profitable, huh?
Yeah. And scalp hunting offered a quick profit for men trying to reach California, and the bounty of one Indian... The bounty of one Indian was worth more than many Mexicans or Anglos could earn in a year. It also provided financial rewards for a conflict that had begun before a price had been set on Indian blood.
That goes on, too.
Yeah, but it's amazing, folks. It's truly, truly amazing. So, just to let you know that...
And what we did to the American Indian isn't much different from what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians.
No,
they took a real page out of our book, but close to it.
But you know, Hitler took a page out of the Hitler copied our extermination plan for the Indians, okay? For the Jews, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And now the Jews are copying the same thing for the Palestinians. So, you know, amazing, isn't it? Oh, God. I'm so pleased to hear that the Republicans have finally put together an impeachment caucus for Obama.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty good. Let's see. We've got a few more minutes, and Dan will be calling us, hopefully.
He's going to call in?
Yeah, he's calling from Spain. And that's why we have to do it a little late tonight. But
for every dollar spent on these federal programs, bang for the buck, here's how much they put back into the economy.
Yeah, temporary increase in food stamps. We put it for every dollar spent on the federal program. For instance, food stamps put in $1.67 back into the economy. Extending unemployment insurance benefits puts in $1.49. Back into the economy for every $1 the government spends.
Energy assistance, $1.11.
Across the board tax cuts only bring in 95 cents for the $1 spent. Okay.
Make dividends and capital gains tax cuts permanent, 38 cents.
On the dollar.
Yep.
And and corporate tax rate is 32 cents.
So you can see those Republican ideas
are bull.
They don't make money for the rich people. They don't bring any money
into the economy.
No,
right?
Or very little.
So, you know, there you go. So, I'm going to do. I have Dan on the line now. So, hang on 1 second, and we'll put him on.
Hello.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Thanks for calling. We loved your book. You know, really.
Oh, good, excellent. Thank you very much.
Great book.
We introduced. I read part of the prologue as well, and I wanted to ask you one. Just where the a heck of it. Here it says, the year is 2015. It is a time of great intervention. Why did you choose the year 2015? Was that anything prophetic there, or was it just for
No, this is the in the strategic trends report, which is the basis of the book. It's the report that I actually came out of the 2005 Bilderberg meeting in Germany.
Yes.
And became the basis of you know, what later on became the UK's government's you know, national requirements document. And in that document, they're talking about 2015 as the point, you know, the breakdown point where all these things will happen. And one of the things that they're talking about is that by the year of 2015, two-thirds of the world's population is living in the areas of water stress, and over 50% of the world's population is living in urban rather than rural environments. That's why I said 2015.
The interesting thing is, and I'll say, is that what struck me about the 2015 was that a friend of mine who was a cosmobiologist, he was an astrologer, used to be on my radio show for a number of years. He made a prediction that 2015 would be a year of, now this was, he made this prediction in 2006, okay, that the year of 2015 would be a year of revolution in the United States. Now, I'm wondering I questioned him on that. He said, no, he says, everything shows it. This guy predicted 9/11 a year before it happened. He predicted Iraq's war, the Iraq war, 2 years before it happened, and the death of Saddam Hussein.
We had a lot of faith in him.
We had a lot of faith in his predictions because they were so accurate.
Well, there you have it. 2015, big year.
That struck me. That really did. So do you feel could that possibly happen? I mean, your book is very prophetic. Do you feel that that actually could be a moment of, for instance, in the United States, we're going to have an election in 2016, all right, and that's going to be kind of a critical year.
It's not only a critical year for the United States. I think, you know, one of the conclusions that I reach in this book, Transevolution, and the subtitle I think is great, The Coming Age of Human Deconstruction, is that, you know, literally we're living at the cusp of the greatest change in the history of mankind. And, you know, what from here on in, you know, the entire world will change at such a breathtaking pace that, you know, their definition of humans and human beings and people will forever have changed, you know, very, very shortly if we extrapolate everything we know, everything we've learned, and where we're going with this technological advancement to the future. And one of the, I think, conclusions which will make a lot of people, you know, sit up and think, is the fact that, you know, the generation of our children, the kids who are 15, 20 years old today, they are really the final, the last truly human generation on the planet Earth. Their children, in other words, my grandchildren, and their, you know, children's children, they will no longer be human. They'll be transhuman. They'll be post-human. They'll be man-machines. There'll be cyborgs. There'll be beings who are not human because of what we have discovered in synthetic biology and how we can change our, you know, DNA through genetically modified crop, and how we can literally today, with technological advancements, create beings in a laboratory without any help from anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that, I mean, aside from the metaphysical aspect of such a, ignoring that metaphysical part of this, is there no soul in these people? Is there no, are they all robots? Are they all, completely dehumanized?
I don't think so. You know, it's, there's a lot of, what they're doing from their point of view makes a lot of sense. Now, I know that some people misunderstood what I'm trying to say, in my interview. They're saying, Estulin, sold out, is now part of the, the transhumanist movement. No, not at all. I don't think people quite understand what I'm getting at. Technology is an amazing thing. You know, if the 19th century was all about revolution of harnessing energy from fossil fuels, in other words, oil, and the 20th century was about, exploiting the power of data, this century is about controlling biology. And what's amazing is that, you know, we can literally change the makeup of what people are. Now, what the elite are doing, you know, the transhumanist, you know, elitist globalist agenda is make this divide between them and us even greater. If in the past they controlled knowledge and then they lost that control because we had access, you know, to computers and Google and we could just type anything into the computer and get immediate answer, and suddenly, you know, what these people, you know, got in their secret society meetings, you know, and get-togethers, which was passed on from generation to generation in a very, 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 you know, narrow way, then suddenly anybody, you know, in any part of the world, whether you're sitting in a tree, you know, in the middle of a forest, in the middle of a desert, you know, you have a computer and access to the Internet, you have access to all human history's knowledge over the past 6,000 years. So what they're doing now is through technological advancement and through the gazillions of dollars that they have, they're creating this technology which is so out there and, you know, in space, then, you know, that completely has changed the dynamic of what humanity is all about. And the idea that these people have is not only, you know, live forever in cyberspace, not as, you know, you and I understand immortality as people, you know, with flesh and bones and blood. No, they don't care what a physical appearance is all about. It's the idea of being able to download your consciousness into an avatar of your choosing and live forever, combined your, you know, consciousness and intelligence with the intelligence of billions of other people in what they call hive mind. And these kinds of things already exist, except it's not called hive mind, it's called cloud. And everybody has cloud on their computer where you can upload your files, except in the near future, you won't be uploading files. You'll be uploading your consciousness. And this is part of the transhumanist agenda of changing the world around us, changing humanity, changing the meaning of what it means to be a human being.
Now, do you see any benefit to that, or do you yourself personally?
Well, you know, again, technology is an amazing thing. There are 7 billion people on the planet Earth. It's a small planet with limited natural resources. You know, what's going to happen in a generation? We're going to get to 10 billion. How about when we get to 50 billion? How about when we get to 200 billion people? There's simply not enough space on the planet Earth for all these people. So on the one hand, technology is an amazing thing, but it all depends what you do with this technology. I'll give you a really simple example. You know, you can have, because of this technological advancement, because of the, you know, this convergence of quantum revolution, industrial revolution, and above all else, computer revolution, we have the ability right now, you know, a doctor sitting in his office in Philadelphia can operate on a child who is dying of brain cancer half the world away. But all using almost the same kind of a technology, you can have a general sitting in the Pentagon and order a drone strike on somebody also half a world away. So it all depends how you use this technology and for what purpose. But again, what I said before about, you know, the population, you know, ever greater population on the planet Earth, we need to get to the point where sometime in the future we're going to leave planet Earth and we're going to conquer the galaxies. And that's our calling, because what separates us from animals is this divine spark of reason, which, you know, allows us to discover universal principles of nature and which help, you know, to improve the lives of everybody on the planet Earth per square kilometer of space against nature. And again, talking about technology, on the moon, for example, you have this amazing isotope called helium-3, which is very rare on Earth, but it's the ideal element to realize nuclear fusion, which we need as the best energy source on the planet Earth. So just on the surface of the moon, you have enough helium-3 to provide really clean and safe and the best source of energy for the entire planet for the next 2,000 years, we don't need to worry about oil. We don't need to worry about this fracking. You know, people said to me, well, why are they doing this? I don't know why they're doing this. It really makes no sense whatsoever when you have this amazing technology, you know, can get us to the moon and get this amazing, you know, sources of energy which will improve the lives of everybody on the planet per square kilometer of space against nature.
Well, I think I understand what you're saying, definitely. I've been an advocate of, against these things for years and years and years, but I think what you're... If you don't mind me quoting you in your book, and I really like this short paragraph. Again, that prologue was tremendously eye opening. I'm glad it was well written. But it says, "Quote, let's see, is it? You were quoting the Anthony Burgess novel, Clockwork Orange." And he quoted, such a group becomes easy to control. You know, once you beat down the gangs and, we're talking about apathy takes over, preceded by mindless violence, which is the characteristics of the Los Angeles street gangs in the 60s and the 1980s, and what Emery Trist called organized social responses to disassociation, as described in the pages of Anthony Burgess' novel Clockwork Orange. A society dominated by infantile animal-like rage. And then he said, such a group becomes easy to control and will docilely follow orders without rebelling, the object of the exercise. And then what's more, the disassociated adults cannot exert moral authority over their children because they are too involved with their own infantile fantasies brought to them through their television set. And if you doubt what I'm saying, look at the older generation today as they have accepted the moral decadence of the no future generation of its children rather than seek conflict in the process. The adults have come to accept a low moral standard. And that really shook me because it's so true what's going on today.
Again, the technology is being developed right now. For example, remember that film Men in Black? The Hollywood science fiction.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Uh-huh.
There's this technology in the film called amnesia beam. Okay. Well, this kind of stuff already exists. Okay. Now you can have that. Using neuroscience and the system itself is called active denial system (ADS), and it's a byproduct of larger ongoing research looking for technology that could delete and then replace a person's memories via the use of electromagnetic radiation, just as we have in Men in Black. You know, now scientists say that. For example, the seeds.
You had it called MK Ultra, correct?
Well, MK Ultra is another. It's a different operation. But this is technology through electromagnetic radiation. You know, the scientists claim that the seeds of criminal and antisocial behavior can be found in children as young as 3, and the researchers believe that violent tendencies have a biological basis, and that tests and brain imaging can pick them up in children. So by predicting which children have the potential to be trouble, they're talking about treatments could be introduced to keep them on the straight and narrow. And that's the kind of stuff which is actually being implemented and tested right now and put forward by 2 leading American criminologists of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Washington. And again, please understand that these are not publicly funded projects for the betterment of humanity, but they're mostly secret experiments sanctioned in the name of defense, which when you put it on its head is crime prevention and extrapolated into the future is tailor-made to put down any rebellion by 99% of the world's population destined to live in abject poverty in crime-infested megacities of the future.
Well, that's a pretty bleak view.
Well, this is the the base of my book is the Trans-Evolution is a report which came out of the 2005 Bilderberg meeting called Strategic Trends Report. And, it talks about all these technologies, neuroscience,
yes.
The study of the nervous system, how the advancements in chemistry, computer science, engineering, medicine, and other disciplines, neuroscience literally now includes the study of the molecular, cellular, developmental, structural, functional, evolutionary, computational, and medical aspects of the nervous system. So now, you know, scientists know everything there is to know about our nervous system. And there's a TV series right now on Fox called Almost Human, which is
right.
one of the main characters is a cyborg cop. Now, you know, Hollywood is not just any kind of an industry, you know, there to make money and to entertain people. It's part of, you know, this powerful juggernaut controlled by the man behind the curtain. And, you know, it makes sense to pay attention, you know, to these kinds of films. I don't mean, you know, Driving Miss Daisy kind of films. I'm talking about high-tech films, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at some of the high-tech films out there, just to give you an idea what's out there for people to realize, you know, G.I. Joe 2, you know, the nanotechnology in that film already exists. Prototype, that's a film which is, you know, it's in making process, and they're talking about a singularity. Transcendence, that's coming out, I think, in the next month or so with Johnny Depp. And that's an amazing film, you know, where Johnny Depp is this famous scientist who is killed by this terrorist anti-technological group. And as he's dying, what they do is they upload his brain, his consciousness, onto the computer, and his consciousness tries to take over the world. Gattaca, that was a great film with Jude Law. Well, they're doing exactly this, you know, choosing, you know, genetically choosing the people, which is, again, you can do that through the synthetic biology. Public Enemy with Will Smith and all that stuff we see now with NSA. Moon, that was a great low-budget film about the future of humanity. Minority Report. Do you remember Minority Report?
Right. Yeah, that was amazing.
That was John, you know, with Tom Cruise. And his character, if you remember, John Anderton, you know, had a radical surgery to replace his eyes so that he can get past security systems. Remember that? That scanned his retina to identify him. And he's lying in a tub recovering from this black market procedure. Remember these little tiny robots sneaking into the room and scanning his eyes, you know, trying to track down the fugitive future crime officer? Well, the ability to scan retinas to identify people, you know, it's straight out of science fiction film, but outside of the use of spider-like drone bots, this is very much present and very much near future. When I say near future, maybe 6 months to a year max. In fact, in the next year, you know, your eyes may not even need to be in close proximity to the scanner to be identified. And that's what engineers at Southern Methodist University are doing, you know, along with DARPA, to develop a new type of eye scanners that could identify a room full of up to 2,000 people simultaneously. You know, then there's films like Avatar. Well, this is very real because, again, one of the plans for the transhumanist movement is to be able to, by 2035, to upload your consciousness onto an avatar of your choosing. Then there's the video games. And the best one there is, if people are not familiar with it, is Deus Ex, D-E-U-S, and the second word, E-X. Check it out. It's an amazing game. I'm not talking about the game itself, but what it represents as the game, you know, what it stands for, what it shows you. And again, people have to understand that, you know, these technologies, they're not being developed to stop the terrorists. They're being developed to stop you and me, to stop us, the people, and the laws to justify these technologies were not written on a whim. They're specifically designed to give the government, you know, complete authority over the people during this chaos and confusion of this period they call the Age of Transition, transition to a planetary civilization.
Well, this is all goes in with the ascension, Age of Ascension. You know, being, I don't know if it was being disguised that way or what, but, you know, supposedly now as we enter this new age, we are entering a higher consciousness, right? I believe that's happening. You see it all over the place. You see it, that's why everybody is going, is revolting. That's why you're having so many revolutions. But what I wanted to ask you was, part of your book, you said that the financial collapse, okay, the world economy has been planned down to the mm-hmm. down to the dollar, right? And how do you now once that happens, once we do collapse, which will be very soon, based on the way things are going, how will they?
What's the next step?
And what's the next step? How do they pull it all through all together to developing a one world currency?
You know, it's not. It's a one world currency is a stopgap. It's the whole point is quite different. You know, I'm convinced that part of what the elite are after is literally emigrating from the planet Earth. And again, people listening to this, you know, they're saying this guy is crazy. No, I'm not crazy at all. And I think I've proven that in my book, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, that, you know, the things I was saying, and you know, all of them have come true. The point is that the idea is of destroying society. You know, again, it makes sense from the elite's point of view. There's 7 billion people on the planet Earth. And for them to eat, most of us have to die because progress and development is directly proportional to population density. They understand this. They've known this for the last 300 years. You know, Gottfried Leibniz talked about this 300 years ago. So they understood it very, very well. For them to survive, most of us have to die. Killing us is expensive, first of all. Second of all, there's going to come a point where people, you know, figure it out that they're trying to kill us. So they're doing this, you know, through different techniques, through different ways of getting at us. One of them is obviously wars. Another one, you know, and another one, you know, you have hunger all over the world, disease. But then again, you can deindustrialize the world. You can reduce the use of technology. You can bring, you know, the world, you know, to the zero growth mentality. And if you don't have any growth in technology, if you don't have any growth in, you know, in industrialization of the planet, then it's going to come a point where, you know, this population curve is not going to be able to sustain itself because we simply won't have the technology, you know, to supply life for such an enormous population base. So this is what they're doing. And again, if you go back in history and not very far, you know, to 1972, for example, the Club of Rome, they wrote this report called Limits to Growth. And they're saying that in this report, you know, they said that the Earth was going to run out of its limited resources in the next 40 years. Well, we haven't run out of the resources in the 40 years, so now they've come up with another report, you know, Limits to Growth in the next 40 years. But no matter how you look at it, organizations, you know, Malthusian depopulation schemes, which is what Club of Rome is all about, you know, according to them, you know, for mankind to survive, we have to adjust our lifestyles and, you know, accordingly the numbers of people on the planet. And what they're suggesting, along with people like Al Gore's and Prince Charles's and so on and so forth, you know, that mankind must reduce its dependency on technology, roll back our drive for progress, technological innovation and advancement, and impose a worldwide regime of economic-controlled disintegration. And needless to say, if we, you know, go into this disintegration, retrogression mode in technology, we will reduce the world's population by several billion people, and that's genocide, in case people don't understand. And this is their agenda. This is the agenda of the elite. This is the agenda of, you know, the transhumanist movement. This is what they've been after all along, except that, you know, they're very clever in how they present these ideas
well,
to different movements.
I agree with you. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, in your book, you talk about genetically modified foods. You talk about geoengineering. You talk about the climate, chemtrails, basically, mm-hmm. geoengineering, and you talk about eugenics, and we've been talking about this for years on this show and trying to make people understand. But man, when you see it all around you, you see it in the skies, you see it in the food you're eating, you see it in everything, but yet people refuse to see it. You know, we see it, but billions and billions of other people cannot see it, refuse to see it. Even intelligent people just seem to glaze over when you talk to them about it. Even when you point it out to them in the skies, when you show it to them in graphic detail, they still don't get it. So how do you? I don't know. I just so often just throw up my hands and just say, it's coming. You know, it's coming, folks. You know, I don't know what you're going to do to prevent it, but it's coming. You know, what they're mostly concerned about is the police state, but you know, they don't even know about, you know, that they're breathing in aluminum oxide. They're breathing in, they're eating all this harmful food. I don't know. How do you explain it to them?
I think people have to understand that, you know, food is power. And when it's used to cull the population, it becomes a weapon of mass destruction. Now, people may not realize it, you know, but the Rockefellers of the world, they certainly know exactly what it means. And, you know, there's no better way or cheaper way to reduce the population than through starvation. And in order to starve people to death, you must take control of the food production away from independent farmers and put it into the hands of giant corporations subservient to the interests of the World Company Limited. Because, again, this is what... on the world stage, what is happening? You're destroying nation states, countries. You put these countries, you merge them into these, you know, all-encompassing unions, which is what we have in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
North American Free Trade Agreement. You know, and now this, NAFTA, CAFTA, Mercosur, European Union, all of these, groups of countries being merged together into one. But it's not so much, It's not one world government, as a lot of people, you know, like to think. It has nothing to do with one world government. The concept is different. It's the concept of one world company limited, corporations that have a lot more power than any government on the planet. We could see that. It's the corporations that run the world. And these corporations are run by the people who run the world from behind the scenes. So it's not the Obamas. It's not the Rockefellers. These are nobodies. And I want people to understand this, that David Rockefeller is a nobody. Not because he's not powerful. He's being popular, being well-known, is not the same as being powerful. And he's well-known, and he's popular, just like Angelina Jolie is popular, but doesn't mean that they're powerful. Really, truly, you know, powerful people are unknown in history. And if you type Rockefeller's name into Google search engine, you're going to get about 20 million hits. And that should tell you that he's a nobody. Because if you type really powerful people's names into Google, they don't exist. And I'll give you one name, Frescobaldi's, which is the root of all the royal families in Europe. And I found this guy's name going through the 14th and the 15th century notary registries in the National Library in Florence in Italy, where I spent 3.5 years researching this stuff. And I suddenly, you know, came across these names, and I started adding up all the acreage that they, you know, kept buying and selling and buying and selling. And when I added it all up, I said to myself, wait a minute, that's about 80% of Italian territories in the hands of the people we don't even know exist. That's power, not the Rockefellers or the Rothschilds. They're not powerful. They're famous, and that's not the same thing.
Well, do you have a name of a powerful person here in this country?
In the United States? You know, the United States is a fairly youngish country. It's been around for just, you know, a few hundred years. Real power, you know, like the Rockefellers, their wealth goes back about 150 years. The Gates' power, you know, a wealth goes back about 35, 40 years. You know, Warren Buffett is an old man. You know, his wealth goes back, let's say, 50 years. But I'm talking about people whose wealth goes back about 1,000 years. Now, that's a lot of years of making money, okay? And a lot of these families, you know, which is the root of you know, what's today called the Bilderberg Group, you know, they go back to, you know, let's say the Fourth Crusade, which is around 1200, 1204. That's, you know, 800-some years of making money, or even further to Charlemagne in France to the year 800. That's 1,200 years of making money. That's power. And these powerful families, you can call them the Venetian black nobility. They go back to Venice, okay, and Venice was the power, okay, in the region for a very, very long time, okay, until the, the first great financial collapse in 1345 when the banks of the Bardis and the Perutis collapsed and brought upon, you know, Europe, the black, bubonic plague epidemic, which wiped out half of Europe. Well, today's crisis actually is worse than that crisis, but the idea is the same. Okay, we're talking about the Venetian Fondi model of power, and this power basically has perpetuated itself throughout history, and that the same families, the same powerful organizations, which simply moved from, you know, from its Adriatic base to another base in England and the Netherlands. Okay, so that's the base of power right now. But the model itself hasn't changed. It's still the seat of power on the world stage. And people talk about the Rockefellers. It simply doesn't make any sense. Yes, Rockefeller is a well-known name, and he's powerful, but he is, you know, his power pales in comparison to real world power.
Now, you stated in your book about the black nobility that they actually go back to the Romans. Is that correct?
Well, exactly. You know, if you look at the you know, at the Venetian families, at what Venice stands for, you know, it's you can talk about, you know, the Roman Empire, the, you know, the you can talk about the, you know, Babylonian Empire, but it gets to the point where, you know, you're talking about the Venetian black nobility, the Martinists, the Synarchists, you know, the Bilderberg organization, and all these other, you know, fondy organizations together, which is just, you know, your typical funds. You know, tax-free foundations that you have today. But the seat of power, you know, it hasn't changed at all. It's still the same organizations working on the world stage, you know, for a very, very long time. You know, you can talk 1,000 years, but certainly enough. And, you know, the transition from the old Venice to the new Venice involved the movement out of the Adriatic region, which was a rather limited, you know, geographic domain. And, you know, it made sense during the latter phases of the Byzantine Empire. But, you know, as the center of this oligarchical financial power, it simply shifted, as I said before, to the Netherlands and Britain. And you know, they became the two centers of this power. And one of the characters, who was one of the founders of the Bilderberg Group, is Prince Bernard, you know, was an appropriate person because, you know, he was a core hardcore Nazi on the one hand, and he married into the Dutch royal family, which was one of the two seats of power of this new Venetian system.
Let me ask you one other thing. What part of all of this does the Catholic Church play? And not only Catholic Church, but also the, say, the Muslim religion.
Well, you know, the whole thing about the church itself is interesting in the sense that, yeah, again, you have to go back in history. You had, you know, in the 14th century a Great Depression, an absolute destruction of civilization. And then in the beginning of the new century, there was this evolution in the process of recovery, which coincided more or less with the birth of, you know, one of the greatest, you know, men ever born, a cardinal by the name of Nicholas of Cusa. Then you had the role of Joan of Arc, you know, her revolt against the Norman system. And despite what happened to her, I mean, she was burned at the stake and everything, you know, led into the process through which this Council of the Catholic Church, which led to this great Council of Florence. And, you know, that was the beginning of modern history. And modern history superseded medieval history in 1439 at this Council of Florence, when the institutions which distinguished modern from medieval history were put in place. And there, you know, there are different institutions. One was the concept of modern nation-state republic under the government of natural law. And the second, the central role of the fostering of scientific and technological progress as the mandate given to the republic. And these two ideas, led, you know, by the Council of the Catholic Church at the Council of Florence, you know, represented crucial arguments that their existence as an institution in any part of Europe changed everything in all of Europe, and these changes increased the rate of development per capita and per square kilometer of mankind over nature. And that was the basis of you know, the role of Catholic Church at the, you know, the creation of modern state republics.
Now, the great war really between the Freemasons and the Catholics, Catholic popes. Okay, what was the? From what I can gather, the Masons became the, you know, because of that war with the Catholic Church, they became the pirates. They became the international financiers. They created the world economic world monetary system, the first monetary system, world monetary system. Is that correct or am I wrong?
Not exactly, because again, you know, if you're talking about the monetary system, again, you have to go back to the Venetian nobility, because that's the system, you know, that came out of the old Venetian model. It's they, you know, who created the monetary system which we have today. Unless you're talking about the you know, the Crusaders, which is a completely different, or you know, the Knight Templars, which is a completely different thing. But the point is that you're looking at, you know, the at the growth of the population and the system that we have today. All of it came out of the out of France in with Louis the 11th, beginning in the 1460s, and again, all of that came as a result of everything that had happened with the Catholic Church, Nicholas of Cusa at the Council of Florence, which again destroyed the feudal lords who controlled Europe with an iron grip through the Middle Ages, you know, and created the idea of freedom and nation states, equality, and general welfare, which we have today, and the idea, of course, of constitutional republics based on the principle of general welfare, you know, the, you know, got its roots initially with Louis the 11th in France.
Was that all manipulated by these families, or was that all manipulated by the Venetians, you know, to further capitalize on chaos and formulating of governments under their control, or what?
Well, you know, initially you had, you know, the Roman Empire and the Byzantine Empire, you know, you control the Venetians. You always had the situation where sovereignty was only the emperor, or, you know, sometimes the pope. But the emergence of the first, you know, the first monarchies, the nation states, was a very painful, very difficult process. It turned out that it was only, you know, defense of the common good, because if you have supranational institutions over large territories, then it always serves, you know, the privileges of monarchy or nobility, or some other, you know, moneyed elite. So, you know, the concept is not new, when, you know, as far as what the oligarchical model is all about, which is really the model for it has not changed in character, only in design. So if you take away how the Roman Empire kept the population down through the circus, and, you know, the burning of Christians, the bread and, you know, circus and so on and so forth, and if you look at the modern entertainment, which is doing exactly the same thing as, you know, with the modern population, dumbing people down, preventing them from, you know, thinking strategically and so on and so forth, then you can see that really nothing has changed in principle. What has changed are the forms. So we really are talking about, you know, the old structure. And it's the same old structure that you have today with the European Union. So that really hasn't changed. It's been the same oligarchical imperial structure for the past 4,000 years, you know, at some point, beginning with the Persian Empire, et cetera, going with the Greeks and so on and so forth.
Maybe you can, maybe, because I know you live in Spain. Now, Spain is undergoing a tremendous economic and political upheaval there. And I wondered if you might be able to explore what's happening there, as well as what's happening in the Ukraine, these struggles that are going on. What's the basic cause of these, and are they orchestrated what's the plan? Are they orchestrated by the Bilderberg architects, or are they just spontaneous combustion of
No, there's nothing spontaneous in anything. Always something, you know if you look at the Ukraine, you know, to actually get, you know, thousands of people in one place, somebody has to organize it, somebody has to pay for it. It's, you know, it's not free, it's expensive to do that. Propaganda is expensive. To get, you know, the media out there, you know, explaining things from a certain perspective, you need a very well-oiled machine with a lot of money behind it to do this. I don't know if you remember back in 2005,
right,
we had, you know, the famous, you know, Mohammed cartoons, which were published by Politik in a Danish magazine.
Yeah.
And suddenly you had this, you know, antifa all over the world of Muslims screaming bloody murder and, you know, and calling for, you know, for the death of all whites on the planet Earth. And you know, we had millions of them from Morocco all the way to Indonesia. And if you look at, you know, it's about a, you know, it's a big chunk of Earth. It's like half the planet Earth. And all these people are out there, you know, parading and screaming and yelling and, you know, killing themselves and burning Danish flags all over the world. But, you know, as you know, the commentators were talking about, you know, bin Ladenists and terrorists and extremists. And, you know, the only thing that I wanted to know was, where did these millions of people across the world get their hands, and how did, you know, these people get their hands on Danish flags? Because you had millions of these people with Danish flags.
Exactly.
Now, where the heck did they get them? I mean, do you have a Danish flag at home?
No.
Do you have an American flag at home? You don't.
No,
I don't have a Russian flag at home either. Most people don't. So unless, you know, you had a Danish flag that came along with a, you know, with a Koran, which I don't think that to be the case, somebody somehow must have supplied these millions of people with a Danish flag and very precise instructions what to do with it. But that's only the first part of it. You know, just imagine you have a Danish flag and you decide to burn it. And unless you burn it at home, nobody but you and your wife will see it. So for the entire world to see you burning this flag, you must make sure that the media is there, you know, watching you, videotaping you, and then putting that videotape out so some big fat guy in New York eating his, you know, cheeseburger with potatoes can actually see it on his television and come to a conclusion that, yes, these people are terrorists and extremists. And this is exactly what's happening in the Ukraine. This is being orchestrated from behind the scenes. This is your typical coup d'etat organized by people who are anti-Russia because they know they can't get at Putin, so that what they need to do is they need to get at the nations which are next to Russia and are Russia's natural friends, as is the case with Ukraine. And this is what is being done in the Ukraine. And as far as Spain is concerned, Spain doesn't exist anymore. It is no longer a nation state. It is now a protectorate controlled by the people with money on the world stage. That's another example of One World Company Limited. Anything of value has been bought up and everything else has been given back to the government, and they know that the government that has no money is going to try to borrow from the people, but as the people don't have the money, what they're going to do is they're going to try to somehow come up with the money that they don't have in order to pay the debts, which they cannot pay ever. So what they're doing is they're destroying the system, and they know that the system is being destroyed, but it doesn't matter because the point is you destroy the nation states, you empty out the country, you leave the shell, and then you take that money and you go somewhere else, and this is being done across Europe and across the world. And you can see it in Detroit. The country, you know, it's in the United States. Detroit was the motor city for decades. It's been the motor city. Well, it doesn't exist anymore. It looks like a bombed-out, post-apocalyptic shell of what Dresden looked like after World War II. And this is a great example of what is being done to America, you know, today.
Yeah, it's really, really sad. Do you have any hope for the future? I mean...
What is the hope? What kind of
hope? I certainly do have the hope. You know, the elite have been trying to, you know, do this to us for thousands of years, but we're still here. And, you know, more of us than ever. And no matter what they try to do with transhumanist movement, you know, downloading our brain to the computer and creating your virtual reality human beings, you know, the divine spark of reason is something ours, individual, and you could never replicate it. That's why it's a divine spark of reason. It's something that's so intrinsically human that no matter whether you're Ray Kurzweil, you know, or anybody else, that's something. This is the signature that defines the human being, and they will never be able to replicate it. No matter what they do to us, we will always be human beings. No matter how they try to change us, they will always be that, and they will never take it away from us.
Yeah, I believe you in that. I really do. But I think... Our last note, I just want to, one other thing I wanted to ask. How does Israel play into this
plan, the
World Corporation and the destruction of the world as we know it? How do they play into this?
You know, Israel, if you go back to the, you know, to the creation of the state of Israel itself, it was a British creation of the British Empire. So the point is you put this white state, you know, Jewish state in the middle of an Arab, you know, Arab terrain, you're going to have exactly what you have today. And especially when you have these people running the country who are, you know, to say that they're not well, you know, mentally well, I think would be an understatement. So you have this continuous strife, which is what you need. But it's not only in the Middle East. You're looking at the world stage, be it in Africa, be it in, you know, former Soviet, you know, Union or Soviet, ex-Soviet republics. Anywhere, any conflict, it's divide and conquer. You provide, you know, guns and butter to both sides of the equation, so you always make money from both sides. You get your people on the ground, and if, you know, if it's not your territory, you get United Nations troops in there. You try to pacify the territory. You take it over. You take over the natural resources. You know, you get rid of the people you don't want in power. You, you know, get rid of the of trade barriers. You get rid of the, you know, boycotts. You bring International Monetary Fund. You bring in the World Bank. You take over the territory financially, and that's how World Company Limited works. It works the same way, be it in Panama, being in Nicaragua, in, you know, South America and Argentina, be it in Russia when you have the, you know, loans for shares auction, literally overnight, you know, destroyed 40% of the Russian population's wealth. It's the same concept, the same prescription, you know, medicine, which has been put in place by these people who run the world for, you know, hundreds of years. But the system itself, it's still, it's your old Venetian system of control. That hasn't changed in the past, you know, 800 years.
Well, this country was founded on it.
Colonization.
Same thing with...
Where
can people get your book?
Yeah, is it on Amazon?
Well, they, you know, they can get it on pretty much anywhere in the United States. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at Barnes & Noble. They can get it by, you know, going to my publisher's website, trineday.com, or they can, you know, call them at 1-800-556-2012. But again, you know, this book is available pretty much everywhere in all the outlets. It's you know, it's been out for about 10 days, and it's a huge success because, again, I think the subject is the first book in the world that actually talks, you know, creates this three-dimensional model and shows people exactly how technology and space exploration and synthetic biology and money and, you know, transhumanist agenda, how all of these elements fit together into this one model created by the globalists, you know, with the, you know, with one purpose in mind, you know, using through technology, controlling the world and getting back their upper hand that they lost because of all these revolutions such as quantum revolution and technological revolution and biotechnological revolution. And again, all of it is based on this one report which came out of, you know, 2005 Bilderberg meeting called Strategic Trends Report 2007-2036, which you can download for free from internet. It's 91-page, you know, source document. Amazing reading, just to give you an idea what the elite have been planning for us for a very long time. You know, it's certainly worth to read it to believe just, you know, the extent of long-range planning that these people are capable of.
One of the most eye-opening documents I ever read was Global Report 2000. All right, the Global 2000 report. You don't quote that. I don't think you mentioned that in there. But that was the first document, basically, that I ever saw of that came out of the early 1970s under Carter. Carter administration, all right, and Zbigniew Brzezinski and Kissinger signed was director of it, and what it was that they wanted to reduce the world population by 2/3 by the year 2050, all right, that was the goal and the object, and they were it said everything about how they planned to do it, and all of the presidents since Carter have had to sign off on it. Okay, even Obama has signed off on it, as far as I know.
Well, that's the whole point of the globalist agenda. You need to reduce the population. According to them, there are simply too many people. So, again, on the one hand, they're destroying the population. But on the other hand, they're using this technology to basically create this, you know, enormous gap between, you know, control that they have in their possession and the rest, you know, what we have for the rest of us.
Exactly what your book is stating, that how they plan to do it, and it spells out how they want to do it, which is virtually, you know, every means possible of genocide you know, that they can, that they can use, because their goal was to reduce by 2050, reduce the world population by 2/3, okay? So that was frightening to me. But the fact that you had 2045 as the changing year, all right, caught me, and I said, oh, God, he's right on track. So there are many, many other plans that have that date as a date of change, huh?
Absolutely. Date. Listen, I hate to interrupt, but it's 3:30 a.m. here, and I'm going to go to bed.
Sorry.
We appreciate the fact that you came on and spoke with us about your book, and I'm sure it's going to be a great success. It's already started that way. And we look forward to having you on again.
Anytime you want. It was a pleasure being on your show. Thank you so much.
So much.
Thank
good
you
night.
So much.
Take care. Good night. Bye-bye.
So, I want to thank you very much. For being
the poor guy, 3:30 in the morning.
Yeah, I understand. And, this is a fascinating subject. And, again, the book is called Transevolution, The Coming of Age of Human Deconstruction. All right, by Daniel Estulin, and you can get it at Trine Day Publishers. Go to TrineDay.tr.
No, somebody else has books there.
He did.
Several people
he
that
did.
We've got on.
Yeah, he was the first one.
The first one, yeah. I recognize the publisher.
Yeah, Trine Day, they're out of Oregon. They're actually in Oregon, but TrineDay.com is the name of the company. And their website, and you get the book right there. I suggest you probably buy it from right from there. It's let's see, $24.95 in the United States. It says, TrineDay.com. TrineDay, PO Box 577, Walterville, Oregon, 97489.
I wonder why you've chosen to live in Spain.
I don't know.
And that was another bloodless revolution.
He sees it, to take it over. I mean, yeah. I love the guy's forthrightness. I love his, the way he wrote his book is like...
It's very understandable.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
And there's no mystery to this, and they make no secret of it.
But to you and I, there's none, because we've been studying this for, since we began. Yeah, probably 2000 when we first.
As they pointed out, there are no random acts. Everything is planned. There's a grand plan.
Yeah.
So. But I found it interesting that he said the names that you know aren't the real power.
No.
Like Rockefeller and
Gates,
Rothschild and Gates. They're the latecomers.
The people that have made some money in the last
50 years or a couple of hundred years.
Yeah, and if you look at the Queen of England, who's supposed to be the wealthiest woman, the wealthiest
mm-hmm.
person in the world,
mm-hmm.
Worth trillions of dollars, because basically, let's face it, England still has, 2/3 of the world in the Commonwealth of England.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So all of that land and all those monies and all that.
All going to her.
All going into the coffers. So, that's, they're the wealthy. And her legacy goes back a 1,000 years or more, to the Saxon kings,
Oh, no, that family's German.
Oh, German king. So, anyway.
All the kings came out of there.
They combined German and England and all of these different...
They're not English at all.
Show here, but we thank Dan for being on.
And he was great.
Yeah, he was.
I just love listening to him, what he had to say, the historical part, which I was not clear on.
Very clear, very well researched.
I didn't realize it went all the way back, the plan went all the way back to the Venetians.
It goes back to the Romans.
To the Romans, even further back, but he concentrated on those Venetian families.
Going into the Egyptian the Egyptian secret society, and he talks about them, how it developed from there, and the control of these different countries through food and through,
they're still doing it the same way.
Same thing, same happening. So anyway, that's the show.
And thanks for being with us, folks.
And join us tomorrow. We got a whole lot of new
Union news tomorrow.
And all kinds of stuff. So
have a good night, folks.
Have a really good
night.